Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where we welcome another guest on today to have a chat with us. Welcome to Mike Moles, who is the Technical Director of Covango. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. I'm happy to be back in England after a sort of enforced stay in South Africa. Yeah, it's good to be back.
Great. Morning, Kenny.
Yeah, morning, Mark. Morning, Mike. I assume that enforced stay, Mike, was COVID related.
Yeah, yes. I went out there on the 9th of March, and I have a house in Cape Town, which is very fortunate. Obviously, I intended to go out to Botswana and to have a look on what was going on out there. And of course, that was about as bad a timing as you could have organized. And I think within about 4 days of me arriving there, South Africa got locked down, and I was stuck in Cape Town without my wife and family for just over 10 weeks. And, you know, it was, it was okay. I mean, I could still work and I could still talk to my fellow directors and so on Skype and so on. So it wasn't that much of an inconvenience. I suppose it was more being away from the family and so on, which was a slight problem.
So it was complete lockdown then? It was like no one's allowed to move anywhere.
Italy. Yes, it was much stricter than it was here. Actually,
yeah,
absolutely nothing. The airports were closed. There was no international flights, no domestic flights, no travel of any description from even within the city. It was very tight, and I think still is far stricter than here in the UK.
I think South Africa's done pretty well. I don't think there's been anywhere near the level of deaths that there has been in the UK.
No, so that's true. I mean, I think that seems to be throughout the whole of Africa generally. I mean, some countries have done better than others. I mean, there are countries like Kenya, I think, has done very well, Ghana, but they've taken it all very seriously. But of course, you know, the big thing is that in Europe and North America, there are far more old people and people who have, underlying health issues. And generally in Africa, I'm afraid those people are already dead. So, you know, the death rate, just isn't anywhere like it is here. And so the figures, of course, do look a lot better. And I guess the other thing is that generally speaking, you know, Africa are not so good at collecting statistics. So you don't really know how many people have contracted the disease and how many people have died, really. But it's nice to see that in South Africa and Botswana, you know, they're taking the whole situation very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff. So talking about Africa, Mike, obviously you've spent your whole career almost in Africa. Can you take us back? You can go back as far as you want, even to your school days or early days. You know, what made you get into geology? You know, what was the path that you chose? And then we can perhaps move on to some of the companies you've worked for and the projects you've worked on.
Sure.
Really, the floor's yours.
Well, my sort of route into geology was rather a long and tortuous one, really. I mean, I went to school here in Devon. I actually broke my neck playing rugby, which was quite a serious injury, obviously, and I was fortunate to sort of recover from that eventually. But it did mean that I didn't get the required A-levels to go into geology straight away, which is something that I had rather dreamed of doing.
Yep.
And I spent a year out, you know, what do they call it, a gap year,
doing
sort of social work in Bristol. And then eventually I got onto a degree course in African studies at Birmingham University. And I did a degree, I got my degree in African studies, which was a sort of mishmash of politics and economics and whatnot. And then I got a job as a teacher. I taught in a inner city school in Birmingham, which is pretty rough. You know, I was sort of young and idealistic in those days and thought that I could make a difference. I think after 3 years, I realized I wasn't making much of a difference and I was headed for an early grave probably. So I got out of that and I retrained as a diesel mechanic of all things. And I got my City and Guilds as a diesel mechanic and got a job with British Rail, stripping down diesel engines and putting them back together again. And I did that actually for 5 years, probably longer than I should have done, but the money was good. And I quite enjoyed it, actually. I was a shop steward on the sort of maintenance side, which was quite enjoyable. But, of course, you know, my sort of passion for geology was still sort of lurking there in the background. And I thought, well, I don't want to be, you know, climbing in and out of diesel engines for the rest of my life. So I managed to get back to university and did my degree in geology. And I got out with a geology degree in 1986. And then, you know, I wanted to do exploration geology. At that time, all the geologists were going off to the North Sea and sitting on oil rigs, and I didn't really fancy that much. Mm. Although I think they got paid quite well. And I had some friends in Zimbabwe. So I thought, well, I'll go off to Zimbabwe entirely on spec. I didn't have a job or anything, and I just sort of jumped on a plane and got out there. And you know, you had to sort of find a job within 6 months and get work permits and what have you. But I was fortunate enough to get a job initially with an Australian exploration company, Delta Gold, who had a few mines actually in Australia, and they were keen to develop something in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I spent 4 years, I think, with them. I worked on the Great Dyke. So Delta Gold were the people really who sort of opened up the platinum deposits on the Great Dyke, which was quite interesting. And then I moved from that company to a startup company called Reunion Mining. And this was a British listed company, which, you know, had some quite dynamic people setting it up, and it was quite exciting. And I got a job as a senior geologist. You know, by this time I was quite a bit older than most people with my experience, so I found that sort of because of my age, I tend to sort of rise up through the ranks rather more quickly, probably. So I eventually became exploration manager at Reunion Mining. And you know, they were that was 8 years. They were great. Really enjoyed that. Fascinating work. And I worked all over Southern Africa, in Namibia, in Zambia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique. And we eventually pioneered some work on the Scorpion deposit in Namibia, right out in the Namibian desert, actually within the sort of exclusive diamond zone, but the property was owned by Anglo American, which allowed us to go in. In fact, it was owned by Anglo American, And we drilled that out. I was responsible for the drilling. There was somebody else responsible for a feasibility study. But we put the feasibility study together, and it was a big success. And Anglo-American, who owned the property, wanted it back because we'd sort of done such a good job on it. And so they ended up, rather than buy the property back from us, they just took over the whole company, which was much cheaper for them. And that sort of resulted in the demise of the company, really, and we were all out of a job. So that was the end of those 8 years. I then got a job as a consulting geologist to Lon Min, I think, Lon Min's gold division.
Yep.
Which was a sort of senior position. I did that for 2 years. They were looking to extend their resources on their gold mines. It was okay. It wasn't really what I wanted to do, but it was reasonably well paid. But eventually, I thought I should start up my own business, which I did in, when was that? That must have been about the year 2000, I think. And so our first little project was to acquire some ground on the Great Dyke, which is this sort of platinum-rich feature that runs down the whole length of Zimbabwe. Okay. And the northern end was a section of the Great Dyke called the Snake's Head. So we acquired licenses on that, and we did some work on it, added value to the property. I think we had it for about a year, and then we sold the whole thing to a company called Afplats, which was eventually sold itself to Impala Platinum. And we did quite well out of that. You know, we made a chunk of money from the sale. And I thought, well, this is what, you know, I wanted to do, you know, to have my own, to run my own business, and to go wherever there were opportunities to add value to properties, to mineral deposits, or discover new mineral deposits. Mm-hmm. And by adding value, you then sell them on to companies that want to mine them. I was never very interested in going into mine geology or developing mines. Exploration is what I really enjoyed and what I felt I was good at. So the next job, well, Zimbabwe was then, you know, the sort of the political situation in Zimbabwe deteriorated quite badly thereafter. From about 2001 onwards, I think Mugabe had sort of really lost the plot. And at the end of the day, mining companies were just not investing in Zimbabwe. They weren't interested. And really, that was my source of income. You know, I had to attract. I mean, there were plenty of good opportunities in Zimbabwe, but if you couldn't find a buyer, you couldn't find anybody who wanted to invest in Zimbabwe, there was no point doing any exploration. So I moved. Up to Malawi. I moved the whole family up to Malawi. By this time, I had two children and a wife that I collected in Zimbabwe. Okay. And we moved everybody up to Malawi, to Lilongwe. And I worked on a heavy mineral sands project there, which was heavy minerals on the beaches of Lake Malawi. I mean, Lake Malawi is an amazing lake. I mean, you can't see from one side to the other. It's about 550-odd miles long, about 50 miles wide. Huge sort of inland sea, really. Massive. And There were big deposits of heavy minerals. Unfortunately, having worked on the project for a number of years, we were let down rather badly by the government, who kept on promising that they had done a deal with the Mozambican authorities on importing electricity. We needed to smelt the heavy minerals, and we had got to a point, more than halfway into a feasibility study, and it became clear that the government hadn't signed the deal that they said they had signed, and so it all sort of evaporated. But in the meantime, I had been there'd been a civil war in Mozambique for years. I think it went on for about 17 years. Nothing had happened in Mozambique. It was dead. I mean, there was no activity. There was no mineral exploration going on. But I had frequently traveled between Malawi and Zimbabwe by road. And when you do that, you pass through Tete, which is a big town up in the northern part of Mozambique, and you could see the coal just in the walls of the road cuttings and things. And for years, I've been looking at this coal, thinking one day I'm going to come back here and do something about this. And I hooked up with some friends, well, they later became friends, who were running a very small little coal mine. Out of Tete. They were supplying coal mainly to Malawi and tobacco farmers and the fertilizer industry. And I made contact with them and we talked about it and we decided to team up together. And we took out 16 licenses over everything that we thought may have coal below surface. Just, I think by chance, really, there was at that time, there was a big shortage of coal, particularly metallurgical coal. And suddenly everybody was looking for metallurgical coal. The price of metallurgical coal went through the roof. It went up to, like $130 a ton. And there we were sitting on one of the world's largest coal deposits that had never been properly mined or evaluated. And so we had a lot of people that were wanting to do deals with us. And eventually we did a deal with an Australian junior mining company called Riversdale Mining that owned a small little coal mine in South Africa somewhere. And we sold the whole lot to them for shares, mainly for shares, a bit of cash. And then we were all escrowed for 12 months. And during that time, the share price went up by a factor of 10. So we all made a huge amount of money out of it. And it really didn't take us long. I think it was less than a year from the time we took out the licenses to the time we sold the whole thing to Riversdale. And of course, Riversdale, I mean, people will probably know the story. I mean, Riversdale sold it on about 2 years later to Rio Tinto for billions, I think, $3.5 billion or something. And I think that it didn't work out very well for Rio Tinto. They couldn't get the coal out. I mean, I think they thought they would be able to ship it out along the Zambezi River. But when they did the feasibility studies, they realized that the Zambezi River was, unnavigable, basically, and they ended up by virtually giving the whole thing away. Anyway, that didn't bother us too much. We made quite a bit of money out of it. I went on then to I set up another company called Rio Mazoi, which was looking at a zinc deposit also in Tete in Mozambique. I actually lived in Mozambique for a while, on and off. What a place. I mean, it's the hottest place on earth. It's like terrible. I mean, steamingly hot. It's one of those sort of places which is, it's like a sort of hole that the heat just sort of builds up in there. And anyway, I got used to it in the end. Anyway, so we eventually sold Rio Mazzoi to another Australian junior, which I think are still going. I think they're called Battery Minerals, or no, Battery Metals. And it was around about that time that I got together with one of my colleagues from my reunion mining days, a geophysicist called Hilary Gumbo, because he had moved out of Zimbabwe. He's a Zimbabwean. He moved out of Zimbabwe to start to set up a geophysics consulting company out of Francistown in Botswana. So we were chatting and talking about Botswana, and I'd always really liked working in Botswana. I'd worked on two or three projects during my days at Reunion Mining. And what we particularly liked about Botswana was the fact that two-thirds of the country is covered in Kalahari sands, you know, the windblown sand dunes, which have now stabilized, and they've got, you know, little scrubby trees growing all over it, but you can't see the rocks. There's nothing visible on surface. And so, and this is right in the heart of Africa. Over terrain that has elsewhere produced some of the world's greatest mineral deposits. And this area had been virtually unexplored because, you know, you couldn't see the rocks. But, you know, technology had moved on a lot, and you could actually, of course, you can see through the sand remotely by using geophysical methods by and large, but also soil sampling. And we decided that if we were going to find a really big mine, there was a good opportunity to find a really big mine under the Kalahari sands in Botswana. So that was very exciting. Stability is terribly important when it comes to mining investment, because you're looking, if you're going to develop a mine, it can take you 10, 12 years to even establish a mine. And then your mine has to run for 20 or 30 years thereafter. And you can't have a situation where there is a lot of political instability. Mm-hmm. And so mining companies like Botswana, so it fitted very well with the sort of concept that we had in mind. So Hilary and I, we decided to, because he was a geophysicist, we got out all the geophysical maps, and of course the whole country had been surveyed regionally through various aid programs and so on. And I suppose the first thing that really jumped out at us was this extraordinary 450-kilometer long geophysical anomaly which ran down the southwestern side of Botswana, totally covered in sand, so you couldn't really see the rocks, but it had been drilled by a Canadian aid program in the early 80s. I think they put about 7 holes into it to see what it was, although I think most people had a good idea what it was. And to cut a long story short, it turns out to be following a deep-seated discontinuity in the Earth's crust, shall we put it like that? Mm-hmm. So, and up that discontinuity means like a very big, deep fault, or the edge of a rift, or mm-hmm. the edge of a craton. This allowed magma to rise up along the discontinuity and become emplaced within the rocks in the Earth's crust. And this magma, when it's solidified, we call it gabbro.
Obviously, but we're getting on to the point now where Kavango was born.
Yeah.
Could you maybe give us an outline how Kavango was was born out of your interest in Botswana and Hillary's obviously as well.
Yeah, well, so Hillary and I, we decided that we were going to do some work in Botswana. So we set up Kabango Minerals, and then I brought in two of the colleagues from my days in Mozambique, who'd all made money out of our deal with Riversdale. And we all put some money in to get things going. And, you know, the object was to acquire some licenses and start carrying out some work. And we were going to use, first of all, we were going to use geophysics. And of course, as I said before, Hillary was a geophysicist, you know, a very good geophysicist. So, you know, he was able to carry out some geophysical work to help us see what was below surface. But we'd also worked for a number of years. We'd been working on a soil sampling technique to identify metals which are coming up from sometimes very deep below the surface. You know, we're able to detect now metals which come up through the overlying strata onto the surface, and you can pick these metals up. They're in the form of metal ions, and they form a little Jura crust on the surface of the sand. Mm-hmm. Because the metal ions are dissolved in water, and particularly in arid conditions, the water gets sucked up, and the metal ions themselves get left behind through the transpiration process, and they form this little crust. And you can, if you scrape up this crust, you can identify these metals. So that helps us get some sort of idea of what lies below, and particularly if there are any mineral deposits.
Yeah, they're almost like pathfinders for, as you say, for what lies below.
Yeah, exactly.
So just moving on to Kabango, obviously Kabango's got sort of three major projects. You've got the Kalahari Suture Zone, you've got the Kalahari Copper Belt, and you've got Ditto. Can you maybe just give us a quick overview of each project, Mike, and where you're at in the exploration process?
Yeah, I mean, Ditto is about 60, 70 kilometers to the west of this long 450-kilometer magnetic trend, which we call the Kalahari Suture Zone. And we picked that up primarily because it had some very interesting geophysics. There was a sort of collection of what looked like ring structures coming through. And we took out a license there, really, because we weren't too sure what it was, but it looked really interesting. And we eventually put a couple of drill holes into this thing. Our suspicion was that these ring structures were related to something called carbonatites. Carbonatites are very strange, like little mini volcanoes that are composed almost entirely of calcium carbonate. And for many years, people thought that they were some sort of sedimentary bodies, but in fact, they are entirely volcanic. And they were sort of geological curiosities. They had sort of strange things in, like, they were a source of strontium and thorium and niobium and rather sort of esoteric metals. Yeah, and of course, rare earths. Well, that's what I was coming on to. Yeah, so rare earths, again, were a bit of a sort of strange curiosity from a geological point of view up until quite recently. But in the last 20, 30 years, well, 30, 40 years, rare earths have become more and more important particularly in the sort of electronics, and they are now particularly of interest because they use, in fact, the term rare earths is a misnomer. I mean, they're actually metals. I don't quite know how they got the name rare earth. So forget the earth bit. They are strange elements that occur in the periodic table, and they all have slightly different physical properties. And some of the physical properties of these rare earths are very useful in the electronics industry. But particularly now, they're in huge demand because of the search for high-efficiency batteries for electric vehicles. Everybody's now beginning to wake up to the fact that these rare earths are really important for, you know, the future development of many high-tech applications. So that's why we thought, well, we need to sort of hang on to these things and see if we can drill them out and test them. That wasn't our main focus. And so recently we've done a joint venture. We've joint ventured the Dittau project out to a company called Power Metals. And they've taken a 51% interest in the project. They're going to fund some of the exploration. And, that sort of allows us to concentrate more on the other projects.
Yeah.
So our main project is this thing called the Kalahari Suture Zone, which is the 450-kilometer zone of gabbroic intrusions. And what we're looking for here are what they call magmatic sulfide deposits. Now, when the magma rises up to the surface, if the magma content contains appreciable amounts of sulfur, the sulfur attracts copper and nickel and other metals to form what they call metal sulfides, mm-hmm. Which are, when they're in the molten state, they are heavier than the molten silica, which forms the bulk of the magma. And because they're heavier, they tend to sort of pool in certain locations, in certain trap sites. They can form significant ore bodies. The biggest magmatic sulfide deposit in the world is in Norilsk in Siberia. And it's a huge mine. It's the biggest copper nickel mine in the world. And it also has appreciable amounts of platinum group metals as well. And we felt that there were distinct similarities between what we were looking at on the Kalahari Suture Zone and on what we were able to discover about the Norilsk deposits in Siberia. And this became even more so when we looked at the core, which had been drilled by the Canadian-sponsored drilling program in the early 1980s. One of the great things about Botswana is that they look after the core very well. If anybody drills any holes, you have to hand the core from the drilling over to the Botswana Geological Survey. They have big core sheds where they store all the core for future reference. And so that reference goes way back to the 1950s. And so you can go to the core sheds and you can ask for them to get the core out so that you can have a look at it. So Hillary and I looked at the seven holes that had been drilled into the Kalahari Suture Zone. And the guys there were amazing. You know, they got everything out. They helped us. And we even had some junior geologists who were interested to sort of sit with us and watch what we were doing. So we re-logged the whole lot of the of the core. And the first thing that we realized was that most of the gabbros that we were looking at, in fact, were quite young. And previously, I think it was assumed that most of the gabbro was much older, like a billion years old, very ancient rocks. And we noticed that most of it, in fact, was much younger. It was of Karoo age, which is about 180 million years old, which is very similar in age to the Norilsk deposits. The second thing that we noticed was that the gabbros, as they came up, they seemed to prefer to intrude into coal measures. And so there's a lot of coal in Botswana. But of course, there's a lot of substandard coal, which we call coal measures, which are not pure coal, but a mixture of coal and mudstone and what have you. But as in Norilsk, it was clear that large amounts of this coaly material had been incorporated into the molten magma. And the assumption is, at Norilsk at any rate, was that the sulfur, having been incorporated into the magma, introduced large amounts of sulfur from the coal, because coal has a lot of sulfur in it. And this increased the content of the sulfur content of the magma, such that the metals, and in particular copper and nickel, would prefer to team up, shall we say, with the sulfur rather than end up in the silicates, and that is why Norilsk has these huge deposits of metal sulfide. And we were seeing exactly the same thing. You know, we were looking at gabbroic magma, which had intruded into coal measures. Clearly, the coal measures were being incorporated into the magma. And we thought, well, you know, this looks so much like what we were looking at Norilsk. And we got very excited about that. We were able to we could take samples from the core. We sent away quite a lot of samples from the gabbros. One of the analyses that we did was what they call whole rock geochemistry, which is to essentially find out exactly what the rock was made of in terms of, you know, the elements that composed it. And we gave all that information to a colleague of ours that we'd actually worked with while we were on the Snake's Head project in Zimbabwe, the Platinum project. And he was sort of semi-retired at this stage, but he's one of the world's sort of leading experts on magmatic sulfides, a guy called Dr. Martin Prendergast, who now lives in Scotland. He did crunched all the numbers, and his conclusion was that it was very likely that what he called sulfur saturation had occurred, and that the sulfur had combined with the metals in the magma, and that the sulfide, the metal sulfides would have formed what he called an immiscible liquid, which meant that while it was still molten, a bit like oil and water, the silica would separate away from the sulfide, and the sulfide would pool somewhere. He was not in a position, obviously, to say where it would have pooled, but he felt the reasonably confident that the mechanism was there. So this was like, you know, this is very exciting. And we thought that that we had a great chance of finding world-class copper, nickel, and possibly platinum group metal deposits on this thing. So we then needed to do something in terms of finding the deposits. And that, because that, you know, having having the theory was one thing, but finding the deposits is another story. I mean, we were looking at a huge area, 450 kilometers long by 50 kilometers wide. The first thing that we thought we really ought to do was to fly the area, or at least an appreciable chunk of the area, with airborne EM, because we knew that these metal sulfide deposits or created conductors. They conduct electricity quite well. Yeah. And so we wanted to fly as much of the ground as possible. Well, we just didn't have the money to do that. And so we decided to approach another colleague of ours, Mike Foster, who was from our Reunion Mining days, who was living in London, and he had been doing pretty much the very sort of thing that we were looking for, you know, raising money for projects out of London, setting up listed companies and so on. So we approached Mike to help us, and it took us a while to get things sorted out, but eventually we listed a company, a new company called Kabango Resources, in 2018, July 2018. We raised enough money to undertake some airborne EM surveys, and we got some very good results. We got a lot of anomalies popping out. But then, of course, you have to decide what you're going to do with these anomalies and what they actually mean. And we had some geophysical consultants to help us do that, and we started producing some models. We also did some drilling. We drilled six holes in November of last year, really to test the geophysics, and also to confirm some of our assumptions about the prospectivity of the these gabbros. So now we are in a position where we are trying to build up a three-dimensional model of the most prospective parts of the suture zone, or the areas where we think there is most potential. And we're using some very sophisticated computer-generated modeling software that will produce a three-dimensional map, so that you can, you know, you can get into the geology, you can spin it around, you can have a look at it from underneath and from every angle. And what we're really looking for are sort of trap zones, because as the magma ascended towards the surface, it does that through migration along, let's say, let's call them conduits. And these conduits transport the magma towards the surface. As they do so, there'll be little jogs and little changes of direction or faults that occur in the existing geology, which allow the much heavier metal sulfide liquid to pool and form concentrations. So that's what we're looking for. So the idea is that the 3D model hopefully will identify these trap zones. You may not be able to see the sulfides themselves, but the trap zones will be able to. So in a way, it's beginning to look a bit like a sort of oil exploration program. You know, I mean, when you're looking for oil, you're looking for trap zones. Like, mm-hmm. You can't see the oil, but you can see the trap zones. And you say, right, well, that looks a really good trap zone. Let's drill into that trap zone and see if there's any oil there. But we've got one other technique that we can use before we start sort of going off wildcat drilling, and that is we can use very low frequency, very high powered ground-based EM over those trap zones. And we are pretty confident that we will be able to see the actual sulfide deposits using this technique. And in fact, we're going to use a geophysics company that has been working in Botswana for many, many years and is entirely experienced in dealing with the rather difficult environment of undertaking EM surveys over this rather mucky material that's sitting on the top that absorbs all the electricity.
Is there still quite a lot to be discovered in the Kalahari that's buried underneath these sands?
Oh, I would think so. Yes. Look, I mean, you know, we're looking. I mean, most of the ground that we're looking at is sort of what we would call on craton. Now, that's the same as the rocks that you see in Zimbabwe and in South Africa and even in West Africa. I mean, there's potential for gold deposits. There must be large deposits of metals lying beneath the sand or beneath the Kalahari cover. And I'm sure that in due course, you know, there'll be more discoveries made. You know, even the diamonds. I mean, I think Juaneng was found actually underneath Kalahari sand. It wasn't coming to the surface, although it wasn't very deep. I think it was only about 9 meters of cover. I mean, we're looking in some places, we're looking at 70 meters of cover. So, yes, I would, particularly diamonds. Diamonds are easy to see from a geophysical point of view anyway. I mean, De Beers and other companies are doing a lot of exploration for kimberlites very close to where we're working, actually, right now. So, yeah, I would say the future for Botswana mineral discoveries is excellent. But it's not easy, you know. But I mean, you know, you've got to remember that most of the world has been combed over fairly carefully by exploration geologists. And if it's sticking out of the ground, most of the deposits have been found already. It's rare these days to. I mean, they found Voses Bay, which is another big magmatic sulfide deposit up in Labrador, which is a pretty remote place. But I mean, the geologists actually, I think they were looking for diamonds and they just happened to come across this sort of big gossan that was poking out of the ground that nobody had found before. But, you know, if you want to find mineral deposits that are poking out of the ground, you've either got to be very lucky or you've got to be looking in very remote places. Or you've got to be looking where there is some sort of cover. And Botswana, I think, is a good place to discover these deposits.
Yeah, just where we're talking about deposits, Mike. Obviously, Kavango's got another few licenses in the copper belt. Now, there's already been, you know, some pretty major discoveries in there with the Sandfire and Kuprik. Mm. Can you just give us a brief overview of what these guys have got in there?
Yes, well, you know, it's been a bit of a long story. It's taken a while to sort of get things going, but now things are really taking off. So there was a company called Discovery Metals that did a lot of very good work, and they are the ones actually who found the deposits that are now being developed by Kuprik Canyon, and unfortunately, the company went bust a few years ago. Kuprik Canyon picked up from where Discovery Metals left off, and you know, things started to change. I think, first of all, I think Kuprik Canyon have done a very good job in terms of financing, first of all, financing the whole project, but also, you know, in terms of geological discoveries and so on. So, you know, that's they're a private company, and but I mean, the other day I did some calculations on this. I mean, they've got I think they've got over 500 million tons now in resources, of which I think 185 million tons are grading at 2% copper, which is, that's a phenomenal amount of copper. When you think that most of the world's coppers, world's copper is won from porphyry copper deposits in South America and to a certain extent in North America, where average grades are like sort of 0.4, 0.5%.
Yeah.
Where they have to mine huge quantities of rock in order to get a relatively small amount of copper. So this is rich.
Yeah.
Now Sandfire have just produced, you may have seen Sandfire just produced some new drilling results about a week ago. I mean, those are spectacular intersections. Anybody who's interested in the copper belt should get onto the Sandfire website and have a look at those intersections. I mean, they're phenomenal.
Yeah.
So it keeps on getting better and better, you know. And I mean, I'm very glad that we took the decision to at least dip our toe in the water on the copper belt. And I think it's very important that we have a second string to our bow, as it were. So I'm very excited about what we've got and what we're doing on the copper belt.
You're definitely a perfect location with some of your licenses. You're nestled right in amongst some of the Sandfire deposits and
prospects. Well, some companies, when there is a big success, companies rush out there and they start pegging up everything. And, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to be a bit more choosy about the licenses that we acquired. We didn't want to just grab licenses in the hope that we would be able to flog them on to somebody else without doing any work. You know, the Botswana government are too savvy for that anyway. I mean, they don't like that type of behavior. And I think they respect companies who genuinely take out licenses and do some work with the expectation that they're going to find something. And that's what our philosophy really is. Mm-hmm. So we've now got four licenses in our little portfolio. We would like to acquire a few more. We'd probably like to double that. But we are patient and we will only pick up licenses where we think that there is good potential for discoveries. We're now very keen to get back out in the field. I mean, at the moment, Botswana is still locked down. We're hoping that within the next month or so, we should be able to get our exploration teams back out into the field and start doing the work. But I think that it's very important for the company not to have all our eggs in one basket. So we now have an exploration play on the copper belt. We have the Kalahari Suture Zone project, which is at the moment our main project, and we have this little Detau thing which we've joint ventured. So I think that makes, and they're all within geographically. Easy distance of each other, which means that we can sort of run these projects with the same exploration teams and using a lot of the same infrastructure. So I think it's a good fit, and we've got some great guys working for us, and my colleague Hillary really sort of oversees the exploration in Botswana. We've also acquired an extremely experienced exploration manager who is, we're delighted to have got him. I've been trying to get hold of him for a long time. Delighted to have, I didn't poach him actually, but I've been sort of putting pressure on him, and he's agreed to join us, which is fantastic. So I think that the future looks very, very good, and I'm really looking forward to us getting back into exploration mode.
You mentioned gabbros quite a lot. Just, you know, what is? Can you maybe explain just that a little bit more? What that kind of system is?
Yes. I'm sorry. You know, I'm a geologist, and of course, you know, as a geologist, I sort of expect everybody else to understand all the technical terms and so on, which is you know, not very wise. Gabbro is a dark colored rock that is of igneous origin, which means that it comes from deep below the Earth's crust, where the rocks are in a molten or semi-molten state. And through pressure from below, and also ease of access up these sort of discontinuities, the rock can migrate towards the surface. And it's brought up by sort of convection. If you can imagine the sort of a big saucepan full of porridge, the heat generated forms sort of plumes of molten porridge that brings it up towards the surface. And you know, as it cools, it solidifies and crystallizes. And different melting characteristics at depth will produce slightly different rock types, intrusive rock types. So an intrusion is where the molten magma intrudes into the solidified crust above it and cools down and forms a mass. So like a big granite, for example, is a pale colored intrusive rock, which at one time was a molten magma, which is cooled within the Earth's crust. You know, so for example, in the UK, in Dartmoor, you'll see these big tours, I think they call them, you know, rocks that are sticking out of the ground. Those are intrusions. So gabbro is a type of intrusion, but it's composed of darker minerals. And generally, the darker the mineral, the more likelihood that they will contain these sort of metals like copper and nickel and so on.
Okay, all right. And an intrusion is where the rock's broken through the surface?
Well, when it eventually reaches the surface and it sort of bursts out, it forms a volcano and it then becomes a volcanic rock. But essentially, in fact, that's exactly what would have happened in this case. The gabbros are the solidified parts of the molten rock, which solidified below the surface. But during this magmatic event, some of the molten rock would have actually reached the surface and would have spread out across the Earth's surface, forming lavas. So a lava, it's the same stuff. It's just that underground, the intrusion underground, the rate of cooling is much slower. And when you get slower cooling, the crystallization characteristics are somewhat different. So you get much bigger crystals. So generally speaking, volcanic rock, the rock which comes to the surface, cools down very quickly. And the crystals that form that rock are very fine, so you can't actually see them with a naked eye, generally. Whereas a gabbro, which is the intrusive equivalent, you'll be able to see the crystals quite easily.
the teacher part of you is still there. So
Definitely.
Appreciate your time, Mike. And I think it's probably just over an hour now. So that's quite
Once I start talking, I'm sorry, if you wanted to have been short, you should have cut me short and said, you've got enough. But, you know, perfect. Us geologists, we can talk for hours.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think that's us done. Mark, have you got anything else to add?
No, I don't think that. Yeah, let Mike get back to his day. Thank you very much, Mike, for talking to us.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Good.
Well, thanks, thank you very much for the opportunity to tell my story.
No, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's great, mate. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Good. Cheers. Okay. All the best.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.